Morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Fisheries to order, 10 o'clock on Tuesday, March 11th. President or Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Heron, Representative Feige, Representative Johnson, myself, Chair Seaton. I want to remind everybody about their cell phones at this time. And today we're going to go over the subject of mariculture in Alaska. And we have presentations from Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Commerce, and DNR on the status of where we are. And at the end, if we have time, we'll take public testimony on issues from the industry or whoever that wants to bring up any other questions so that the committee can be alerted to anything that might be constraining the industry or problems that are being created. So with that, we'll start with the division of we'll start with ADF&G and Mr. Ragnar, Commercial Fishery. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Regnart. I'm the Division Director for Commercial Fisheries within the Department of Fish and Game.
And you can go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Excellent. I'll have Ron Joseph introduce himself, and he's going to lead the committee through the presentation.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Ron Josephson. I'm the section chief for what we call our Fisheries Monitoring, Permitting, and Development section, which has to do with permitting aquatic farms and hatchery programs in the state, fish resource permits, which are more oriented towards research projects. We issue hundreds of those, all the classroom projects and so forth. But anyway, today we're here to talk about the status of our aquatic farming in Alaska. I have a little presentation I'd like to show you.
Great. Go ahead and proceed.
Okay. So this is a little bit of our overview, and back up one. So you can just see it just speaks to the topics of this presentation, our program mission, our permitting process, where farms are located, and production by state and region, and some issues about seed acquisition and how we're trying to streamline the program. This slide speaks to our program mission. Long ago, we developed a mission statement for the aquatic farming program to permit and regulate aquatic farming in the state in a manner that ensures the protection of the state's fish, game, and aquatic plant resources and improves the economy, health, and well-being of the people of the state. And there's kind of four elements there. There's an operation permit that we issue to an aquatic farm, and there's two types of transport permits. So within the state, it's a statute that you can't possess or transport any live animal or aquatic plant in the state without a permit. So we give a permit for the farmers to get their seed to grow to for their hatcheries and their aquatic farm operations. And there's another one, the aquatic stock acquisition and transport permit. That's got to do with brood stock. Like right now at Aleutic Pride Hatchery up in Seward, they're hatching gooey ducks to produce larvae, which will grow into little spat, which will grow to be a few millimeters long when they'll transport them out to nurseries. So they need a permit to get that brood stock up there. And there's another, the disease-free seed certification has got to do with almost all of our oyster seed comes from out of state. And we certify the sources of those hatcheries, some down in Washington State, and there's actually sometimes we get, if you can imagine, oyster larvae from Kona, Alaska, or Kona, Hawaii, which was Kona, Alaska. Anyway, they have the right water temperatures there, and they've been able to develop a nice hatchery facilities over in Kona.
Yeah, and just for clarification, is it only oysters that can be imported to the state?
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah. So the permitting process, this is kind of a, maybe you would think of a complicated slide, but it's pretty much linear, and the farmers have to get an application from us, and they fill it out, and then we sit down with them and go over it. And the application packet includes permitting from Fish and Game and from DNR, and kind of walks them through the process of what they're going to need to do a farm. And then I'm not going to read all the elements of this. You can look at it. If you have questions about it, I'll be happy to ask them. But once we receive an application, it generally takes several months to get it through and reviewed and make a decision about issuing a permit. But it's a big undertaking, and we think kind of on another scale, a hatchery permit. Many of our hatchery permits have taken several years between when an applicant applied for building a salmon hatchery and when we actually issued the permit, a back-and-forth process for a review and modification and so forth. So
these average just several months, 3 or 4 months?
Well, I would say it's more than that. I would say it's more like 6 or 9 months before we get a permit issued.
Okay, thanks. And I do want to interrupt and sure. Recognize that Representative Gaddis has joined us.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
So here's where the farms are, and you know, I don't see that these show up all that well on either the presentation or on the monitor here, but in South Central we have about a third of the farms are up there, and they're located a few in Prince William Sound, and then quite a few down in Lower Cook Inlet, Kachemak Bay area there, outside of Homer. And then in northern southeast, we have a few farms that are located around Sitka and a couple in Juneau area. And then in southern southeast, there's around Ketchikan. Those are primarily gooey duck operations. And then on Prince of Wales up towards the north in an area we call Nakati, that's where the bulk of the oyster farms are located, but there's also some as far down as Klawak and other areas and around Prince of Wales Island. The aquatic farm sales have been creeping up the last few years, which is an encouraging thing. The farmers have been doing well, and the prices have been good. So you can see that the actual number of permitted farms has been relatively stable over a period of time, and the active farms, there'd be farms with sales, has creeped upward. And this sales by region, it's a little bit shaded towards South Central, but Southeast Alaska's got a pretty good sales numbers too.
And question, in the permitting, is that permitting by acreage, or is that permitting by number of animals that they're permitted to produce?
Well, it's both ways, especially for, well, I think all the farms have got a DNR lease. There might be a couple that are on some patented land, but they get a lease from DNR for a certain amount of acreage, and so that limits the geographic area that they can do. And then we permit by species, and there isn't really necessarily a limit. Well, they submit to us operation and development plan, which tells us how many animals they would like to produce on an annual basis, and then we permit at that. But that's limited probably somewhat by how hard they want to work and how many animals they can put in that acreage. So we haven't really run into any situations where we've told somebody that's too many animals, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Foggy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see, on this slide here, I notice you've got the red line is the permitted farms with sales, and the other one is just permitted farms. The difference, are those, does it take time to get to a point where you're making sales? Is that why there's a difference there, or people just getting a permit to farm and sitting on the land?
Yeah, through the chair. It takes in South Central about 3 to 4 years before oysters will be ready for sale. Mm-hmm. So a person may get a permit, and it takes them a while to get to the point where they would have sales. Southeast, they grow a little faster, but it's still around 2 to 3 years. And there's a few farmers that maybe are kind of like hobbyists, and they really haven't gotten real aggressive about production. So some of those kind of are just waiting, and we're wondering what they're going to do. Does that make sense?
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
Is there a limit on the permits, time-wise? I mean, if somebody doesn't produce by, say, 6-7 years, is it time to pass the opportunity along to someone else, or what?
I'll through the chair. We issue permits for 10 years. This Fish and Game doesn't have provision like that, but DNR has. I think you should speak to DNR about this. They have some usage requirements that they like to see in place.
Good. And they will be up in a little while.
Oh, good.
So when we look at it by species, which this next slide has, you can see that the large proportion of the production by far is oysters. And the gross sales last year were a little less than 750,000. Gooey ducks are increased in numbers that have been offered for sale, and just a smattering of mussels and little neck clams that have been sold in the last year. The next slide shows this is a percent by species, and what we want to show here, two things, just specific to Southeast, how the permitted farms with and without, and total permitted with those with sales has changed in time. And then there was a surge in interest in little neck clams in the early 90s, and then they were making up almost 50% of the sales through the turn of the century, and then as we've gone into this century, they've declined. Little necks just, I don't know that the farmers really figured out how to be real successful at farming them, and they acquired some wild stock on their farm sites, which were harvested, and then there was some production from hatchery seed that they got, but it just hasn't really, and we don't know totally why it's going on, but little neck clams just seem to be down throughout the region in Southeast Alaska and other areas of the state, too, I hear. Now, South Central is the same slide, and there you can see that mussels have been kind of the other species that have been raised at varied levels of production. Never a large proportion of sales, but a little bit of it. And the permitted farms with sales versus the number of just permits is very close to the same here, South Central. This next slide presents two things here going on. One is what the farmers estimate their inventory is on their farm sites of oysters. So inventories have been kind of going down over the last 5 years, and new seed has also been going on. There's been a real challenge getting oyster seed, and this is probably the biggest thing that's inhibiting the industry from growing, in my opinion, is seed acquisition. The hatcheries down in the lower 48 had trouble with what we call acid water and seawater, and that caused problems with them producing seed and larva for export to Alaska and for their own production. And our hatcheries here have kind of struggled with, they have to get larva from down south for the most part. There's been very little actual oyster spawning in the state. It's been more just research than production. So you can see inventories have gone down a little bit. New seed is going down. Sales went up. I don't think sales can sustain that because we don't have the inventory to support it right now. And what we've been doing to try and streamline the program has to do with the application process and the annual reports. These are the two pieces of paper that we deal with the farmers. You know, to start out, I talked about the application they have to fill out, and we put quite a bit of effort into this, and DNR will talk about the regulation changes that are coming up, because we have the functions or the permitting, the concerns of both agencies, DNR and Fish and Game, are many times overlapping. So we have a joint application and a joint annual report. And until DNR gets their regulations finalized, we don't want to go forward with revisions in either of these reports at this point in time. And this is just a last question. This shows Michael Sheets on a farm with Ray Roland. They're working through some oysters. They're cleaning them in the background. And this piece of apparatus in the foreground is what's called a tumbler. They all put that at a little bit of an angle, and then they put their oysters into there, and it's tumbling, going round and round, and it's sorting them. Those different size slots there will allow bigger, smaller oysters falling through, and then there's something that happens to oysters when they're kind of roughened up like that, kind of slapped around and beat up a little bit, that it encourages a formation of the cup, which is that cup shape in an oyster is really desired for the raw oyster market, the oyster bars, because then you contained all that juice in that cup and the meat in there, and they pop off the top, and then you slurp it down. So you guys have all eaten oysters. I can tell you're getting hungry right now. So thank you.
Thank you. So are there questions? I had one, and have you seen any problems in the industry as far as permitting, and then any negative consequences of the process that's going forward, or any problem that you from ADF&G side have seen?
I'm not quite sure, Mr. Chair, of the context of your question. Problems like for the farmer, the process of getting a permit, or from our standpoint of making decisions, or?
Well, really from both, because we're trying to understand, you know, the industry. Hopefully at the end we'll have time to have them come forward and tell us that if they've had problems from their end. But I see that you're streamlining the process, so it must have been more cumbersome than it needed to be. But I think that the items that you're looking for when a permit application comes in, and what would kick out a permit. I guess that's what I'm getting at from your perspective.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think the biggest, in my opinion, the biggest challenge for people applying for a permit is this operational and development plan. Basically, we ask them what their plan is, you know, how many seed they're going to get per year, and how many they expect to produce and sell. And what we often hear is they don't know. They're just going to, you know, they're going to just do the best they can. And we don't see a stepped development. We just see like a million seed a year and a line going down to the bottom for 10 years. That's their plan. And I don't want to, I think it's hard. I grew up in farm country, and you know, you ask a farmer what they're going to be doing 10 years from now. Well, they don't know. It's going to depend on the price of corn or beans, or maybe they'll go into what we used to call soil bank, where they put their land aside, a conservation easement there, and get a little payment from the government to do nothing. But they don't really know. And I think for these aquatic farmers, they don't really know. It's hard for them to know what they're going to be doing for 10 years, but our regulations require us to get that plan for a 10-year plan. And they also struggle with, I showed inventory there. We ask them how many animals they have on their site. You know, they buy seed. Well, some of it dies, and they're processing it, and they're mixing. Some is older than younger because they're grading it by size. So a farmer has a hard time telling you whether he's got 350,000 oysters on his farm or 200 or 500,000. That's what I've seen anyway. And we seem to want that information. They're like, what are you going to do with this information? Well, we don't really need it for regulation. You know, they're permitted to produce what they've acquired as best they can. But because we get inquiries about it, we would like to know that. So there's sometimes a balance, I feel like, from us between what we need and what we would like to have. And we need to kind of balance that. The farmers, again, from my opinion, like to see the statewide perspective. But when they look at it on the individual basis, they're like, well, that's kind of hard for me to give you that piece. But without it, you can't provide the statewide perspective.
And so in your permitting process, if somebody comes forward with a development plan, you said you haven't run into the situation where you've told anybody you're producing more than your plan called for, so we're going to sanction your permit or something. So are the farmers aware of the flexibility around that plan and that it, I mean, is it viewed as an intentional document? It doesn't sound like you have criteria that you had to follow the plan, otherwise the permit is, I mean, it might not be renewed, but it's not going to be lost during the initial term, right?
Right, Mr. Chair. It's kind of a balancing there. If they want to change their operation development plan, they just have to let us know and send it in. So we kind of, if they're not like living up to it from a regulation standpoint, they're failing to do what they said to do. So we have to kind of balance that with being practical and pragmatic, and we definitely go with the practical and pragmatic on this.
Okay, great. Anyone else have any further questions for Department of Fish and Game on this? Okay, and I guess I just have one other question, because we've had the big problem with DVEX down in Sitka. Are there regulations that Fish and Game has currently on the importation of gear from other parts and decontamination of that equipment, or is there a prohibition on importation so we don't get a redo of the DVEX? I guess that's the best theory, is it came in on nets that were used in another country and they came in with that. So is there anything in Fish and Game's requirements for decontamination or anything on gear that's coming onto the site?
Mr. Chair, we don't have anything specific to that. We looked a little bit at it, and I don't have the reference right now, but one of our regulations that we can put on a permit is conditions to protect the natural resources of the state of Alaska. So we could add a permit, a condition to an aquatic farm permit requiring that any equipment acquired from outside of, say, the state of Alaska, outside of a radius of 500 miles, 200 miles, whatever. I mean, we could put something on that permit. We'd have to talk to law about it. We're stretching our authority if that was the intent of that or not, but we don't have those right now.
Okay, well, I think the committee would like to, I mean, we've been dealing with DVEX in this committee and in resources committee for a while. We finally got, you know, the Elodia at least has now been listed as quarantined, but it's taken a long time to get there. We're looking on the prevention side. So I would request that Fish and Game go back and look at their authority and see if they have the authority to put on a decontamination of imported gear, if it's been used gear in the water. And if not, and you don't have the regulatory authority to implement that, then come back to us for statutory authority. So that's a request from me to the department. Representative Christopoulos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you seen any problems in Alaska with pH, ocean acidification? Has it been difficult or increasingly difficult for farmers to pursue mariculture because of the changing ocean environment?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tompkins, I don't really think I can answer that question. I hear things, I've heard that maybe they've seen some increased acidity in different places, but you know, without a long-term consistent measuring program, there's certainly changes in ocean pH, but I'm not the guy to talk about this, I'm sorry.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. It's helpful to all of us. to get that. So let's go to DEC, Division of Environmental Health, Elaine Boosie-Floyd. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would you put yourself on the record? And we have a presentation from you, I believe.
Yes, sir. Elaine Floyd, Director of Environmental Health.
Thank you. And did you have a presentation for us, or the
I don't have a presentation, sir. We prepared a handout with the overview of our portion of the mariculture industry.
Right, and we have that before us. So would you kind of fill us in on your role in mariculture?
Yes, Mr. Chair. After the permitting and the leasing arrangements are done by DNR and Fish and Game, which they have their presentations for you, then we're required by, under the terms of our shellfish sanitation program, to ensure that the shellfish are harvested from areas free of contaminants. So we classify a growing area, the growing water, based on a very extensive sanitary survey, which includes evaluation of pollution sources, meteorological facts, hydrographic factors that affect the distribution of pollutants throughout the growing area, and physical dilution factors. There's a, again, as I said, there's a pretty extensive process to initially classify a growing area. We take samples under a variety of environmental conditions over the course of a one-year period, and then the growing area is classified according to the information gathered in the survey. Annual water tests are required after that. Then, for the shellfish themselves, we test for pathogens and toxins, in particular paralytic shellfish toxin, PST, but also Vibrio, and there's a third one, but PST is the most common, to certify that the harvested animals, either the area is pre-sampled, and then Fish and Game will authorize the opening of that area that we have said the PST levels are below regulatory limits, so you can harvest here, then they'll open a specific area for a very specific short period of time, because the sampling, the harvesting has to happen within 5 days of the pre-sample. Or we do lot sampling. So those are the things that we're directly involved in.
So I'm presuming that the 5 day harvesting is for a wild sock harvest by divers or collectors, and the farms probably do the lot analysis. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? I'm not positive of that distinction. Okay. I definitely know that the wild harvesters harvest in that 5 day period, but I'm positive about the farms.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure if they could do that or within that or not as well. So, thank you. And I don't know if all the committee members have been able to go to DEC's testing facility in Anchorage. It is a fascinating test. You know, the state of Alaska uses, I think, more mice than any other state in the union, like 20,000 mice a year for testing. With the lots come in, or the sample made up, injected under the skin of the mice, and if the mice dies within 5 minutes or something like that, it's the lot is rejected and has to be. So there's a there's a procedure that everybody is trying to improve and get a some kind of a technological fix instead of a biologic test, but that's our current current method, and if anybody on the committee wants to tour that, we'd be happy to help arrange that. Are there any questions for Department of Environmental Conservation? Well, thank you very much for testifying us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you did have exactly right. We're very proud of our environmental health lab facility, and you did a good job of explaining a complicated process.
Thank you. And let's see, now we will go to DNR. I think we'll go to DNR next. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Wynn Menefee, Chief Operations for Division of Mining, Land, and Water with DNR, and thank you for the opportunity to speak here. I also should have online Adam Smith, and I will introduce, and then I'm going to turn it over to Adam Smith to speak more, and he can introduce himself on the record at that time. First, I'd like to just say that we received a series of questions that we should address, and some of these have already come up in today's hearing, but I'll just run through some of the questions that we're going to address. We do not have a presentation that you or a handout at this time for you. We're just going to go through the questions. We could always follow up with a presentation if needed, but the things I'm going to be covering is there's a question about the fees that we charge for aquatic farm leases, and why is it different than other lease fees that we charge. We're going to talk about the extension provisions or renewal provisions under the aquatic farm program. We're going to talk about what type of lease terms we do to ensure that people are working and utilizing their lease, and we're going to talk a little bit about the issue of can we address hitchhiker species on the gear. And so we also are currently under a process scoping for a regulation change, as has been discussed already, and that in fact Adam Smith is in Homer because we have meetings right now in Homer regarding the regulations. And we do have presentations about those regulations, but as we understood it, the questions weren't specifically about that we received weren't specifically about the regulations that we're going out with. So with that introduction, we do have a program that is working. We have made numerous changes over it over the years, and to try to make sure it's a workable program, but we do recognize that there's certain aspects of it that we need to improve upon to better relate to how the industry is working, and so Adam can cover that. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Adam, and he can run through some of those answers.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, are you online? Would you introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with the looking at those questions?
Sure. This is Adam Smith with the Department of Natural Resources. I'm the leasing section manager that's responsible for the oversight of the mariculture program in DNR. Currently, that is a statewide program administered by one person. We have 66 leases statewide at this time. Like Wynn mentioned before, I'm actually down in Homer now. We had our first scoping meeting last night to basically engage the public to find out what they think of the current regulations and to solicit basically ideas for revamping those regulations. We also have meetings scheduled in Juneau on March 24th. And then also a web meeting on April 22nd. But I'd be happy to take more questions about scoping meetings and regulation ideas whenever you guys are ready. But I don't mind getting going on the questions that were provided specifically with price for lease rates.
Yeah, go ahead and proceed.
Okay. So the mariculture program right now, it's outlined under Statute 3805.083. And basically, it dictates that sites for lease on state tidelands cannot be issued for less than the appraised fair market value of that land. So that is a per-acre component. Right now, that fee is supposed to be reappraised every 5 years and either go up or go down. One of the things that we've been doing internally to reduce costs for our farmers is having a fee schedule developed by our appraisal unit for different activities on state tidelands and uplands. Aquatic farming is one of those activities. So right now, basically for an acre, which is typically, you know, a minimum entry-level farm size, it's $450 for the first acre plus $125 per acre thereafter. So the lease rate is basically intentionally set high through the fee schedule. That's to return a fair amount to the state of Alaska and reduce the requirement for the actual aquatic farmer to go out and have to complete an appraisal at their expense. Now, I do want to say that that is a completely voluntary thing. If a farmer thinks our prices are too high, they always have the option to basically go out and perform an appraisal at their expense and present that to DNR. But the idea of the fee schedule is to come up with a calculated per acreage rate and then have that available for fixing the price per acre.
Fine, and we're trying to get some comparison between other agriculture and other uses. So can you just give us a comparison for, I think we listed grazing, mining, you know, underwater gold mining off Nome, or oil and gas lease acreages that DNR also leases out?
Sure. So I'll talk about grazing leasing next. Basically, that's covered under regulations for grazing right now. And it's basically the value of the leased land is to be determined on the value of the lands for grazing. Now, that's not a straight land comparison, so it's somewhat lower than other fees. Right now, you know, that's determined based on the carrying capacity for the property, winter and summer forage, and other factors. It says right now in current grazing regulations, it cannot be less than 3 cents an acre. That's actually a regulation that was been on the books since 1970. That's been modified by a newer regulation, which is under our standard leasing rates, 11 AC 58410, which basically calls out that fewer than 50 animals grazing on state land, the minimum fee will be $500. And for any other purpose, $1,000. So typically, grazing leases are large acreage leases, and the per acre for the actual grazing component is relatively low. However, if a headquarters site or improvements or infrastructure to support that grazing lease were requested, that acreage would be carved out of the grazing lease and would have to be leased at fair market value. So that's just a bit of a comparison there between grazing and mariculture. Are there any questions?
No, I don't think so on that.
Okay. I'll talk about mining next. So one of the questions had to do with underwater leases for gold mining that were issued by DNR and Nome. Those were offered under Alaska Statute 3805-250B, and those went out through a competitive auction process because there was known deposits of minerals that were valuable there. So it went out competitive bid. And basically the bid is awarded to the highest cash deposit. So that's a competitive process. Other mining opportunities include permits. So if there's not a known source of valuable minerals, a lessee can, or a permittee can start out under a permit and perfect that into a non-competitive lease for that site. Production or royalty taxes are required for mining. It's 3% of the net income, and that's determined through the mining tax return that is submitted to the Department of Revenue each year. So there's actually a land fee plus a royalty tax in that situation.
Okay, and the land fee for those permits that are perfected in a non-competitive, how does that, is that a per acre fee?
It is. In fact, that's covered under Alaska Statute 3805-211. It's the annual rental for mining claims. And there's a calculation for determining those fees, but it hinges on the number of years since that mining claim was first located. And it can be anywhere from as little as 50 cents an acre to upwards of $2.50 per acre. That's supposed to be readjusted with CPI every 5 to 10 years.
Okay, thank you. I think that gives us a pretty good estimation of the range of things.
Okay.
So go on to the next question. That'd be great.
So the next question was, what is the current mariculture extension provisions compared to other state land renewals? And I just want to point out, 2 years ago we were successful in 2012 to get a lease renewal statute passed, and that is under 3805-070E. And basically that grants the authority to the department to renew a lease term if a lessee is in good standing. And the term of that renewal can be identical to the original lease term. Now, under aquatic farming regulations or statutes, we can renew leases. However, it's dictated through a 945 or a public notice process. So one of the things we are hoping to do is bring that in line with our current lease renewal statute. I understand Section 16 and HB 77 is language proposed to bring that in alignment. And so it would read very similar to 070E, where if a lessee is in good standing at the conclusion of their lease term, they would be granted another lease without a 945 public process. It would be public notice on the state public notice website and basically solicited for comment from the agencies.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, go ahead and go on.
Okay. The next question we had talked about or been asked to talk about was, is there a need for escalating lease terms to ensure that people are actively working their leases and not tying up space? And is there a time frame for revoking or terminating a lease on the books right now? Now, Mr. Josephson from Fish and Game did bring up the fact of the commercial use requirement, and that is a regulation in our aquatic farm regulations as we speak. That's under 1180C-63030B, and it reads, by year five, that's kind of the benchmark, that a farmer has to be producing at least $3,000 worth of gross sales per acre or $15,000 per farm, whichever is less. Now, when that was developed, that was back in 1998, and the focus at that time was on oysters. So one of the challenges these days is we have other species online that don't necessarily grow in 5 years. So the one size does not fit all in that situation. But we have in the past used this tool, this measurement tool, to basically engage farmers who got to year five, had not met their production goal, and had conversations about either reducing the size of their farm or trying a different area or trying something else. So it's kind of a measurement tool right now. And one of the things that we're soliciting public input for as we speak through our scoping process is there a better tool? Is there a better management tool that we can use that's not not a one-size-fit-all? So the other thing that we're trying to do right now is make sure that our farmers are completely utilizing the space that they are leasing. We want the leased acreage to be commensurate with the production coming out of the farm. In other words, we don't want huge acreages tied up for speculative purposes without seeing the production coming out on the other end. So that's actually backed up in regulations as well, 58.510 for lease utilization.
And I had a question on that. Is there any distance between farms, or if you tie that into the distance, and of course everybody's looking at needing feed that's plankton, if somebody else gets a farm right next to theirs that's upstream on the current, are there any regulations at all that address the location of adjoining or nearby farms?
No, there's no existing regulations that limit spacing between farms that I'm aware of. The model that that the Alaska Sea Grant and some of the farmers are starting to explore is the cluster farm approach, whereby you do put two to three different farms in a similar area so that you can share transportation costs and share the monitoring costs and classification costs if necessary. So that is something that is an idea out there, but it really, I don't think, is taken off too far yet.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any other questions yet.
So I'd just like to add real quick, one of the other ideas that we're trying to do right now is there's a lot of new technology and new species and practices coming online. One of the things we're exploring is starting an authorization under a permit, a land use permit, which is easier and quicker for the department, cheaper for the applicant to get out on state tidelands to test suitability and test new gear. Currently, that's not really built into our regulations, but we are considering that and coordinating with Fish and Game so that if that is a real option, we can work around the regulatory fixes. But that is one thing I think we can do to help new farmers or new technology be successful.
Good. And what was that being called again?
We're calling that phasing and authorization. Basically, we write a decision for a 10-year lease, but we say we're going to start this lease out under kind of an early entry authorization or a permit, where if they perfect the technology or they meet the benchmarks for production within those first 2 to 3 years, it'll convert or morph into a lease term.
Great, thanks. I'm glad you are looking at ways to accelerate the industry. And let's see, we just had the one other thing that on the list there was a prohibition on the import of gear.
Yeah, so currently we do not have a regulation in the aquatic farm program to address that. That is something, though, that, like Mr. Josephson mentioned, we can add as a stipulation on our permits or on our leases. Yeah, that's clearly something we can do.
And are you addressing those issues with the public in the scoping meetings for regulations currently?
It has come up. We haven't had any direct feedback about that yet. So our public comment period, I should mention, for our regulations is open through April 30th. So it opened up on March 1st. It'll be open through the 30th of April. We're taking public comments online on the Aquatic Farm website and also at our public meetings.
Great. Glad to hear that and glad to get that news out in case anybody in the industry hasn't and the public hasn't heard it yet. Are there any other questions that anyone has for DNR? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. And now let's go to, we have the mariculture industry overview. Go. Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Joe Jacobson, the Director of the Division of Economic Development.
Anybody online, we're just setting up a PowerPoint here, or a presentation. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. So with Division of Economic Development, we're really supporting the expansion of the mariculture industry on two different ways, through the financing side and through the development side. On the finance side, we have the Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund, which we have been administering, and we also have other funds that potentially be used for other assets that would be used on a mariculture farm, like the Rural Development Investment Fund and the Small Business Economic Development Fund, even perhaps the microloan for vessels or an engine repurchase. But the Mariculture Loan Fund would be specific to that, but there are other ways where we can be creative in helping provide financing for farmers. The other side on in our development is primarily through industry assistance, research, and outreach to try to help promote and stimulate investment in the industry and expansion. And we've been working really closely with the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association over the past several years to come up with different initiatives to kind of help advance things. Going over the Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund, the loans are primarily for the planning, construction, and operation of the mariculture business. This is a program that's designed specifically for Alaska residents. You have to have been an Alaska resident for the past 2 years to qualify for this. The maximum loan amount is $100,000 per year with a maximum balance of $300,000 per borrower, and the maximum loan term is 20 years. The interest rates are fixed at the time of loan approval, and payments may be deferred for the first 6 years of the loan. So it's a really flexible program. The current interest rate's 5%, I believe, on this. But it is a loan program. All loans must be secured, and it's something we take seriously. There's the expectation that the funds lent by the state will be repaid. We've been working with ASGA on ways to help make it more accessible to mariculture farmers. So we've kind of reviewed our internal policies in terms of how we view certain types of collateral to help keep it a very secure program, but also make it a little bit more flexible for expanding shellfish growers who may have a lot of investment tied up in product that's actually in the water or in seed or in other things that we previously valued differently. So we've been working with industry to try to make it, like I said, more accessible, and these are things we've just kind of recently done internally, and so I can't really give you an indication of how effective those changes are, but based on feedback from ASGA, they seem to be happy with the steps we've taken, and now we're going to kind of increase outreach and see what we can do to see how well they actually work.
One thing that I had heard was that cooperatives were not able to avail themselves of the loans. Is there any provision that's being looked at for the co-ops, the shellfish growers cooperatives, like the one in Ketchikan Bay, so that they can avail themselves of loans?
Representative Seaton, currently I don't believe we're allowed in statute to loan to cooperatives. I would defer to Jim Anderson for the details of that, but my understanding is that we're not currently allowed to lend to cooperatives. We certainly, if there was a proposed change, I don't think we'd have any issues with that. I think the main considerations that we would have is sometimes with cooperatives or other entities, there's a problem, again, with that everything has to be secured. So how do we, even if it was extended to cooperatives, I think there'd have to be a discussion about how to make the loan program useful for them, because they still would have to provide some sort of collateral for the to secure the loan. So again, it's right now we can't do it. In terms of if we were to do it, I think that would be a question that would have to be addressed, because even when we, if even in, let's say for a corporation or something else, we still have to have a personal guarantee. And when you have an association of folks, it's sometimes hard to get the personal the lien on personal on property that we have secure or secure access to.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out if there's a number of farms, mariculture farms, that are participating in the cooperative. Would it be, I mean, even though you don't have the ability right now, if they were making individual guarantees or pledges, would that work to, is that the kind of thing that would work to secure a loan? Or since it would, if an individual is taking a loan, that would probably secure. But I guess the problem is, just for everybody's information, trying to get seed oyster in Alaska is very difficult. So you have the cooperative trying to work together to produce seed, but you know, financing for that is almost impossible to do because it's a cooperative. So anyway, I think that maybe we can take a look at that and see if we need a statutory fix or what we need. But I mean, we sure don't want to put state money at risk, but if we've got the revolving loan fund to enhance mariculture in the state, and yet we're having seed production being the one thing that's the bottleneck, and yet we can't finance that, we'd just like to talk to you more about that. So if you're willing to do that, we'll avail ourselves of that.
We'd be more than happy to discuss that. I think my main comment there is, for us, there are questions in terms of how it would be implemented. So if we were going to recommend or discuss that, we'd have to really do it in close consultation with cooperatives out there to make sure that we could structure it in a manner that's actually useful for them.
We'll put them in contact with you if they haven't been. So thanks. Go ahead.
So just a bit about fees. All the loan fees have a $100 non-refundable application fee. There's a 1% origination fee due at closing, and the borrower is responsible for all direct costs incurred in processing the application. So in terms of our development projects, a few years ago we conducted an mariculture prospectus, and a lot of the recommendations on that were basically, you know, finding out how to address some financing concerns, research, infrastructure, marketing. And so some of the projects that we're kind of in the process of working on is conducting a hatchery audit of both the Aleutic Pride and Oceans Alaska hatcheries in Ketchikan and Seward. And that's a recommendation that was directly from the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association, that's identified maybe some of the technical hurdles that those individual hatcheries are encountering, and kind of getting in and an independent expert to kind of go through and review the capacity and the process to figure out how to best to address some of the production challenges that are currently they're currently facing. We've also been in discussions about really looking closely at like a business plan. I know we talked earlier about the cluster approach in terms of how best to really looking at this is not from a hobbyist or not from a community development standpoint. While that's certainly important, really kind of getting down to the hard economics of the industry in terms of what's it going to take to make it viable commercially, and to get folks to really commit investment dollars to the industry. Especially if you look at the larger seafood processors that are in the state, a lot of them have interest in shellfish outside of state, or purchase it, or have distribution and such. But I mean, if there's a limited amount of investment capital, we have to present a compelling case of why this industry, or what's it going to take for the industry to be a sound investment that's going to generate good returns from a commercial scale. And so that's one of the next kind of plans we're sort of developing. We're the scope of work right now, again, with the Shellfish Growers Association and also with Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation. And then once we have this in place, then it would be we can take these findings out to industry outside of the state. There have been several articles talking about how because of the ocean acidification issues in Washington, that there have been investments in Hawaii to try to keep hatcheries for production. But you know, we've been looking, well, why not Alaska? Well, I think we want to take that message out and expand the industry, but I think we need a bit more information to really have a compelling case that's based in hard facts. So we're trying to gather those facts, and then once we have them, we can take them out and try to develop the industry that way. So, and then in general, we've been working on a broader maritime industry initiative and how to strengthen Alaska's maritime economy across all sectors. It's really been doing a lot of evaluations of infrastructure around the state, and maritime will be one component of that. So a lot of the infrastructure inventorying and recommendations for future inventory infrastructure investments in different parts of the state would be incorporated into that through a complementary project. So that's really the extent of what we have going on right now specific to mariculture. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are you participating with the scoping with DNR currently on the maritime, meeting with the maritime industry and finding out what problems those are or what regulation changes might improve the industry?
Representative Seaton, I've been in discussions, to be honest with you, I haven't been intimately involved in those changes previously, but I've had discussions, and honestly, it's been one of those things to follow up on, but I haven't been an active member in those.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any additional questions? I don't see any, so thank you for coming. I wanted to thank all of the agencies for coming and giving us the multifaceted look at how this works. And so we're going to open this up for public testimony. There may be industry members or other public members that might wish to testify and give us their take on problems. So if there's anybody in the audience that would like to come forward and testify on any aspects of mariculture industry or any improvement, yes, come on forward and identify yourself for the record and who you represent. Thanks.
My name's Roger Painter, and I'm representing myself. I recently stepped down as president of the Shellfish Growers Association after about 25 years. And so just wearing my hat as an individual citizen. Just wanted to provide a little bit of information to the committee on questions that were raised today. In terms of ocean acidification, the state recently did increase its surveillance of ocean acidification. There's a new permanent monitoring station in Southeast now, and a new one in Resurrection Bay. In addition, on the intake lines of the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery, there's a monitor, and one is being installed at Oceans Alaska's facility in Ketchikan. So the monitoring is being increased. So far, we haven't seen the types of problems that are occurring in Washington and Oregon, although the signs aren't real good out there anywhere in the Pacific Ocean, and we're bound to have problems down the road. In terms of the loan program, I'd like to, in the Department of Commerce in particular, I'd like to commend Mr. Jacobson. We did engage in some negotiations over the loan program, and most farmers have the majority of their assets tied up in their mariculture operations, and the department has been willing to take in as collateral things like crops in the water, gear, infrastructure, farm support infrastructure that hadn't been counted before. So that should allow farmers a lot more access to the program. And I'd also just like to say that, you know, over my 30 years in the business, that we've had a lot of struggles with state government, but things have really settled down in the past few years. I think Fish and Game not too long ago repealed a whole slew of regulations we have been fighting for years. DNR is responding to longstanding requests by the industry to address the five-year production requirement. It takes 8 to 9 years to grow a gooey duck, and some of the other species we'll get into will also have a longer life cycle, so it's really necessary to address that five-year wall that people are running into right now. And just having a good understanding of other mariculture programs in North America, it's easier and faster to get an aquatic farm site in Alaska than anywhere else in North America, and that's mostly due to having a large amount of undeveloped coastline compared to most other locations. But it does take several months to get a permit, but it'll take you years in other regions. So that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. Does anyone have any questions? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Where's the new monitoring station in Southeast?
Icy Strait.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify at this time on mariculture issues? We have Margot Revelle and Homer. Are you online?
Yes, I am.
Would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and then go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Margot Revelle with Jackalof Bay Oyster Co., and I'm speaking for Jackalof Bay Oyster Co., but I also am treasurer on ASGA, on the new ASGA board that's getting going again. And I wanted to just say, for us, last year, we were only able to get about a quarter of the seed that we wanted. So seed is the number one primary issue, and I know that you know that, but I appreciate all the work you're doing on that. But one thing in talking with Fish and Game, when they look at streamlining the permitting process, we found it to be fairly easy. We're new farmers here, working with the NR, working with Fish and Game, and working with the EC. It's a lot of agencies to deal with. It's a big learning curve for us. But I would really appreciate them also looking at the streamlining of the seed certification process and the timing of when that happens. A lot of the seed that we ended up getting was towards the end of the year last year. That puts it in the water for the winter, so they've had no growth in local waters to take off. So having that happen earlier in the year would be very helpful. And as I understand it, there are some issues with the pathology reports and how they get processed and when they get processed. And I think an investigation into that would be very helpful. I also wanted to personally thank all of you for everything you did last year to get those boats out of the water in Jackalof Bay that has made our business possible, and that kind of responsiveness from the state is incredibly helpful to oyster farmers and greatly, greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I ask you, on the seed certification process, are you in contact with Fish and Game on that particular issue? They're here in the room, so if there's any particular questions that you need to pose to them, they can write those down and get back to you.
Yeah, actually, we're at a conference today, so I'll be talking to Cynthia Pringham a little bit more about it, but I just wanted it to be raised up a level that everybody knows that that is a piece that should be looked at. And tied into that is, you know, I understand that we need to get the seed going here in Alaska as well. It's a multi-pronged approach. The oceans are changing, and we need to look at all options. So continuing looking for ways to have the seed facilities here and try to figure out ways for them to succeed, I think that's just going to be an ongoing thing and until the industry really, really takes off. And I think it will. There's a huge amount of promise here. But I will be talking to Cynthia today about that process. But I think there are some issues that are out of her control also.
Okay. Thanks. And Ron is here, and he's, I think he's your chief guy for permitting there. So he's listening to those as well. Great. Anything else, Margo?
No, thank you.
Thank you. And is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Is there anybody else in the room? Seeing none, we will finish with our overview today. And again, thank you for all the agencies and people looking at trying to move our aquatic industries ahead in the state of Alaska. So we'll be adjourned at 11:15.